It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk about a contentious issue in the race for governor, outsourcing jobs. A reporter explains how Wisconsin's business community is reacting to the debate.
First, our next guest is a cardiologist who's become disillusioned with the American medical system. He says doctors are too pressed for time, which leads them to refer patients to specialists and order a battery of expensive tests instead of doing a simple but more time-consuming physical exam.
Dr. Sandeep Chahar joins us now. He's a cardiologist and director of the Heart Failure Program at Long Island Jewish Medical Center. He's also the author of Intern and Doctored, The Disillusionment of an American Physician, comes out next month. Dr. Chahar, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Well, you tell a personal story about your dad getting over-tested in part because he didn't get that physical exam. Can you tell his story?
Yeah, this happened a number of years ago. Actually, it was about maybe a few days after my son was born, my firstborn, and I got a phone call from my brother that my father had been experiencing numbness and tingling in his left arm, and my brother, who's also a doctor, decided to take him to the emergency room, and I thought this is seemed very odd because I had just seen him at my son's birth and he hadn't really complained of anything. So he went to the hospital and I met him there, and a neurologist saw him, and the symptoms were, you know, worrisome, numbness, tingling in the arm on one side. So his symptoms were sort of pigeonholed into the diagnosis of stroke. Mm-hmm. So they did a CAT scan. It didn't show a stroke. Then they did an MRI just in case the CAT scan hadn't picked up a subtle stroke. That was also normal. And then over the subsequent 2 or 3 days, my father had just a battery of tests, an echocardiogram, what's called a transesophageal echocardiogram, where the camera is actually put inside the body and down the esophagus to look at the heart more closely. He had transcranial ultrasound done. He had lower extremity ultrasound. He had CAT scans, chest CAT scan, and so on. And then they couldn't find anything, so they sent him home. And then a couple of days later, he came back to the emergency room with similar symptoms. And so they started going through the whole rigmarole again. And there's a different neurologist on duty, and he ordered another CAT scan. My father was just absolutely miserable at this point, and a nurse actually walked over and basically examined my father, came to me and said, "Dr. Chahar, I don't know if I should mention this, but your father only has these symptoms when he bends his neck." Hmm. And long story short, it turned out he just had a slipped disc, you know, a herniated disc, which is a relatively benign condition. It wasn't a stroke. And it just really drove home the point to me as a doctor, but also now as a family member of a patient, how rushed we are as doctors in jumping to diagnoses and not doing something as simple as a physical exam, which not only could have averted a lot of worry, but could have saved almost $20,000 in unnecessary testing.
And the lesson is not necessarily we shouldn't take stroke risk seriously, but that included in the mix more often should be that physical exam. Why don't doctors do that more nowadays?
Well, I mean, I think it's there are many different reasons. You know, it used to be that you had to do a physical exam because you didn't have any other tools. Now we have very expensive and powerful technologies. We have ultrasounds at the bedside. So it's just easier to order a test than to take the time to do the exam. Also, I believe that, and there's also, of course, the time pressure. You know, doctors are seeing more and more patients every day. They're sort of running on a treadmill. I have colleagues who have doubled the number of patients they have to see, from 15 to 30 in a day. And so you just can't do a complete physical exam. But I think the bigger problem is that there's this fear of subjectivity in medicine today, that we have accomplished so much, but that it's easy to forget, both as a patient and as a doctor, that uncertainty is still the dominant paradigm in medicine. There's so much we don't know, and there's sort of no absolute truth. And I think even as doctors, we're inclined to search for that sort of final or absolute truth through the result of an objective test rather than laying hands on the patient, examining the patient, and making deductions based on our observations. And I think fear of being sued is partly to blame, but I think the larger fear is just a fear of subjective observation and making decisions based on observation.
It feels random and like you're kind of making it up if you're just doing that exam versus this high-tech piece of scientific technology.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the physical exam is not the be-all and end-all of medicine, unfortunately. You know, if you... when I was a medical student, one of my attending physicians asked me, what would you rather have to diagnose pneumonia, Sir William Osler with a stethoscope or a plain old chest x-ray? And he answered his own question. He said, I'd much rather have a chest x-ray because it's just so much more specific and sensitive for picking up pneumonia. And I think that's true for a lot of different diseases in medicine. So there's certainly a huge role for technology. What I object to is reflexively turning to a test and not using the exam and not using the history and not using talking to the patient to filter away some of the testing. So nowadays in the emergency room especially, you'll see a patient come in with some symptoms that are fairly nonspecific, like shortness of breath, and they'll get just a multitude of tests even before a doctor sees them. Tests ordered by a physician assistant or a nurse practitioner, CAT scan, MRI, an echocardiogram. So it's really worrisome, not only because those tests have their own risks, they have radiation exposure to patients, and they have false negatives and positives, but they're also very expensive. And when we're dealing with, the kind of costs we have in this country now, $3 trillion a year in healthcare costs, we have to be smarter about what tests we order.
Well, there's a huge irony there. You pointed out doctors are pressured to see more patients in a day. That's because of cost pressures, I imagine, to save some money. And the result of that is they don't have time to do that physical exam. So their limited time is spent sending people to a really expensive diagnostic procedure. How much is that driving up costs?
I mean, I think that's a huge problem. The number of specialty referrals has nearly doubled, in the last two decades. So the probability that a office visit to a physician will result in a referral to another physician has nearly doubled from 5% to about 9% in the United States. And the number of specialty consultations in the U.S. is a fraction of what it is. The number of specialty referrals in Europe are a fraction of what they are in the United States. the point I made in the New York Times op-ed that came out last week is that it's really easy to look at doctors' payments and say, okay, we have a healthcare bubble. Healthcare costs are expanding at a rate that's not sustainable. Excuse me. So let's cut down on doctors' payments. But the reality is that doctors' payments make up only about a fifth of total healthcare costs. But doctors' decision-making accounts for about 80% of healthcare costs. So the amount of income that doctors earn is a relatively small fraction of the amount of spending that they do based on the decisions that they make. we hospitalize patients, we prescribe expensive drugs, we prescribe tests. And so my argument is that when you're pushing a doctor to see more and more patients, rushing the doctor, he or she is more apt to order unnecessary tests and drive up the healthcare bill. And that inflation totally dwarfs any savings you might get in cutting reimbursement to physicians.
We're talking to cardiologist Sandeep Jahar about his disillusionment with the medical profession, what he thinks we should change to make doctors and outcomes better. We'll get into that a little more in a couple minutes, and we'll take your calls. Do you agree that doctors are too rushed and that they order too many tests? Love to hear your perspective as a patient or somebody on the other side in the healthcare business. Have you had an experience with a doctor or specialist that fits this bill? What do you think needs to change about the way we do medicine? We continue our conversation now with Dr. Sandeep Jahar. He's a cardiologist who's disillusioned with the way we do medicine in this country. He says doctors aren't doing enough physical exams, too quick to send people to expensive diagnostics. That, in turn, is because of too much pressure on doctors to get through a lot of patients in the day. We're taking your calls as well. Do you agree that doctors are just too rushed? They order too many tests, maybe as a result? What's been your experience as a patient, as a professional, somebody in the healthcare business? Call in at 800-642-1234 or just with your questions for Dr. Jahar. 800-642-1234 or email talk@wpr.org. We'll go to Karen on the line in Green Bay now. Karen, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I guess I am in healthcare, and I guess my comment is that I think a lot of doctors feel pressure to order a lot of tests because of the fear of being sued, that if they don't order a test or they make a mistake or there's a misdiagnosis, that there's going to be a lawsuit, and it's just driving up healthcare costs unnecessarily, and people need to take some responsibility for their healthcare as well.
Karen, thanks for the call and the thoughts. Dr. Jahar, is that, you'd mentioned it briefly earlier, is this defensive medicine? We want to absolutely rule out as much as we can, so break out the MRI?
I mean, I think there's definitely a role for that fear in ordering unnecessary tests. And most doctors will do admit to practicing defensive medicine because of the fear of medical liability. I think the recent, the studies are sort of all over, and the data is not totally consistent, but I think there are estimates that defensive medicine accounts for something like $200 billion in unnecessary health costs per year.
Karen, thanks for the call. We'll get back to your calls in just a moment. But Dr. Jahar, you point out in one of the pieces you've written recently is that part of the benefit of the physical exam, and as you mentioned earlier, talking to the patient, asking questions, is the rapport, the connection between doctor and patient that it can build. Why is that an important part of the equation?
Well, I think so much of the diagnosis that we make is based on a patient's self-report, based on the history and the physical exam. Roughly 80% of diagnoses can be made on the basis of history alone, without any tests. And anything that furthers patient comfort to open up to their physicians and tell them about what's really bothering them or go through the history more carefully, I think is apt to be beneficial in terms of making a diagnosis. Also, the care for a patient doesn't just end at diagnosis or at prescription. You have to get patient buy-in to take medications that can sometimes cause discomfort or are very expensive. And so to help with patient adherence to medication regimens, I think building an intimate relationship is important. The physician-patient relationship is really founded on trust, and anything that furthers that trust, is key.
Go back to our callers now. We've got Scott in Eau Claire with us. Scott, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call, and thanks for your time, Dr. Jahar. I wondered if you might speak to the role that capitalism might play in the proliferation of medical testing and perhaps the demands for seeing more and more patients in the same or less time. So I wondered if what role you thought that might play in, and maybe your own disillusionment or what you might see with your colleagues.
So medicine as a business. Scott, thanks for the call. Dr. Jahar, any thoughts?
No, I think that's definitely part of the equation. Medicine has become more and more like a business in the last 30 years. If you look back and see how doctors were practicing before the advent of Medicare, there was, clearly there were a lot of problems with that system, which was very much of a self-pay system where there's a lot of bartering going on and patients were not covered with health insurance. But after Medicare came out in 1965 and with the advent of third-party payments, doctors really had a huge boon to their income. So incomes actually went up significantly after the advent of Medicare, and doctors really started doing more and more testing because of the fee-for-service paradigm that was advanced by Medicare. So I think that fee-for-service has really played a role in creating perverse incentives for doctors to order more and more tests, and that's something that the Affordable Care Act is starting to address. But I think that, the business of medicine is, there's definitely a role for this sort of increasing commercialization and fee-for-service in driving up, testing on patients.
Well, let's talk about solutions to the problems you're raising. These are some pretty fundamental things about the way healthcare works in this country lately. What are some changes, in addition to the one you just mentioned, in the Affordable Care Act that might push things in the right direction?
Well, I mean, there's no clear solution, first of all. I don't have the solution, and neither does any health policymaker. We have guesses as to what may work. One solution that's been advanced is moving away from a fee-for-service payment model to more of a pay-for-performance payment model, where doctors will be paid for achieving certain outcomes or following certain directives. But that has its own problems. Forcing doctors to do certain things may lead to them ignoring other things. And doctors may start to, quote unquote, teach to the test, which is, which can be a problem for a lot of patients. There are also other payment models that have been advanced, bundled payments, so that, paying a fixed fee for a certain healthcare event, like a hospitalization, for example, and then having the doctors who see the patient split up the money based on their own negotiation. So that sort of takes away some of the incentive to order more and more specialists to come onto a case in the hospital when there's a fixed amount of money that the specialists will have to divide up. Another possibility is just going to a simple salary-based system like at the Mayo or the Cleveland Clinic, where you just have doctors on salary, and they earn healthy salaries, and there's no incentive to order more and more tests or to see more and more patients, which I think is there in the private practice model, which has been the dominant model in this country for decades. So, I mean, there are different ways of going about it, and there are pilot projects in place now from the Affordable Care Act that will look at some of these payment models, but we don't know what's going to work. It's the next 10 years or so is going to be very interesting.
Dr. Jahar, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Dr. Sandeep Jahar. He's a cardiologist and director of the Heart Failure Program at Long Island Jewish Medical Center. He's the author of the book Intern, and his new book, Doctored, The Disillusionment of an American Physician, is due out next month.
It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we examine the relationship between the U.S. and Iran from an Iranian perspective.
First, an issue that's become a hot-button topic in the Wisconsin gubernatorial election, the outsourcing of jobs. Governor Scott Walker's campaign released a controversial ad a few weeks ago, accusing Democratic challenger Mary Burke of making her fortune by outsourcing jobs.
The commercial was met with criticism for attacking a Wisconsin business. Governor Walker has doubled down on his message with this ad.
Mary Burke is trying to sell us on her experience at her family business, but she forgot to mention that they make 99% of their bikes overseas in places like China, where her company has outsourced jobs for years. Yet, while Burke's company makes almost all their bikes overseas, taxpayers have had to foot the bill to retrain the Wisconsin workers who lost their jobs here. Mary Burke, job creator? Not so much.
Here to talk about how Wisconsin business leaders are responding to the debate is Jack Craver. He's a reporter for the Capital Times. Jack, welcome back to the show.
How you doing, Rob?
Good. Well, before we get into the back and forth here, you have a recent piece on how the business community in Wisconsin is reacting to these ads. Outsourcing made a political football on both sides. We'll get into that. What's the business community saying here, though?
Well, naturally, the business community doesn't like to hear people bashing what is a pretty common business practice in America today. But what I noted in the article was a couple prominent examples of people involved in the business community who are telling both candidates to shut up about outsourcing because, from their perspective, it's just a part of running a business these days, especially a manufacturer. And they view it as fundamentally disingenuous, particularly coming from a candidate such as Governor Walker, whose political career is basically premised on his ties to the business community and to doing what businesses believe they need to do to grow.
There's been some conservative criticism of the governor, and as you say, from the business community, his response is, I'm not opposed to outsourcing. I'm pointing out hypocrisy from this Democratic candidate. The Democrats are usually opposed to outsourcing, but here's one who's done it.
Yeah, sure. That you can say that, but the ad that you just played right there, that's not about pointing out hypocrisy. I mean, it can be a little bit, but I mean, it's clearly intended for viewers who will react negatively to the notion of a company making products overseas. I mean, that's the point. The point isn't just, he's not just calling on Mary Burke to be consistent. He's saying to people that she's shipped jobs overseas and that's a bad thing and you should vote against her for that. And it's, you know, this is a common tactic in politics. It comes more often from Democrats than Republicans because unlike the Republican Party, which is generally almost all been in favor of free trade agreements that typically are considered responsible for a lot of outsourcing, the Democratic Party is split on the issue. President Bill Clinton and Barack Obama pursued free trade agreements that the progressive wing of the party thinks, you know, aren't good and lead to outsourcing.
Well, and speaking of that split and worries about it, you pointed out that the Democratic Party of Wisconsin polled the public on Mary Burke's history and the outsourcing issue in particular before she announced her candidacy. Do you think that the party foresaw this was going to be a contentious issue come Election Day?
Apparently. And they were. It's hard to know to what extent this issue would have been on the forefront if they hadn't introduced it by allowing that poll to leak. It's always been an issue for her even before Walker started attacking her on it. Progressive activists in the party, progressive media commentators, bloggers were going after her for it in the weeks after she declared her candidacy last year. Some said that this was just it's not appropriate for a Democratic candidate to be associated with business practices that Democrats regularly condemn if they're done by people like Mitt Romney. And then others were just saying that it's bad politically, and that that Walker and company will go after her for it, and she's not going to be able to win.
Right. This won't be a line of attack, probably, at least some analysts have said, that is going to get people to switch allegiance from Mary Burke to Governor Walker's reelection. Could it be something that gets those progressive Democrats you mentioned, labor Democrats, to be less enthusiastic about going around, knocking on doors, maybe less likely to come out and vote?
Maybe. I don't know if that's the intention of Walker's ad, though. I think he's aiming more towards swing voters, people who aren't, most people in the state, even if they affiliate with one side of the aisle, their positions aren't necessarily in lockstep with conservative or progressive political ideology. Things like outsourcing are issues that resonate with people all over the political spectrum. Those are the types of people I think he's aiming for. I don't think that the specific intent of this ad campaign is to depress the Democratic base. Speaking in broad generalizations, I think the Democratic base is pretty committed to getting out to vote against Walker. Certainly the leadership in labor organizations and whatnot hasn't shown any hesitancy in getting behind her candidacy.
Now, in response to Governor Walker's ads, the Mary Burke campaign has fired back. Also on the outsourcing issue, what sorts of things have she and Democrats been talking about when it comes to Governor Walker and the outsourcing issue?
Right. They've said that they've blamed the Walker administration for awarding grants and other types of government assistance through the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation, which the Walker administration runs, for awarding such assistance to companies that offshore jobs. They argue that it's inappropriate for companies that are receiving taxpayer assistance to be apparently using some of that money to set up jobs abroad instead of here. That line of attack is relatively predictable. It's something you would expect from a challenger, especially a Democratic challenger of an incumbent.
And Governor Walker's in the news today saying he'd consider a rule that would limit WEDEC, the development corporation, and have some kind of strings attached to try to prevent companies receiving support from WEDEC moving, he said, I think something like around the world or even across the border to Illinois.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's, again, it's an interesting response. Last year, there have been Democratic efforts in the past in the legislature to tie more strings to government contracts to incentivize the use of American-made products or companies that use American-made products, and Republicans pretty forcefully rejected that effort last year. You can talk to, I remember Speaker Robin Voss was, described it as an absolute, a political stunt that they would, try and, have the demagogue on this issue as he, it'll be interesting to see if Republicans, all get behind Walker and say, yeah, we're going to, make sure that no money goes abroad.
You mentioned that you had heard from a couple of business leaders in the state on this outsourcing issue. One big business voice in the state you hadn't heard from as of publication time, Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce. Have you heard from them yet?
No. And that's not particularly surprising. WMC doesn't typically return my calls, but the WMC, is the state's most important business group. It's a very powerful interest that for definitely more than a decade has been highly strongly aligned with the Republican Party and has already spent millions of dollars supporting Governor Walker through ads that tout his alleged economic successes of his administration. And it would be interesting to see what they have to say about, Governor Walker, who's supposed to be a champion of the free market, going after a company for offshoring jobs. The companies that make up WMC, a large percent of them, at the very least, are definitely engaged in offshoring to some extent, or buy products from companies that offshore. So, but I don't expect them to condemn Walker the way that some others on the right have, because they're so closely aligned with the Republican Party and they desperately want to see him get reelected.
Jack, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thanks, Rob.
That's Jack Craver, reporter for the Capital Times. Ever since the Iranian Revolution and the hostage crisis of 1979, the U.S. and Iran have been at odds with each other. The distrust that exists between the two nations has played a role in a lot of geopolitical events over the last 30 years. That tension remains today in key issues like nuclear negotiations with Iran, which have just been prolonged for another 4 months.
The tone of U.S.-Iran relations has a significant effect on the Middle East and the rest of the world, particularly on issues like the ongoing availability of energy resources, the escalating extremism in the region, Israeli-Palestinian conflict resolution, and the crises in Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon.
What's the cause of the ongoing rift between Iran and the U.S.? How will it affect key events going forward? How can the two sides come together to work toward increased stability and peace in the region?
Sayed Hossein Mousavian is with us now. He grew up in Iran and served as former Iranian ambassador to Germany and as Iran's nuclear negotiator. He's now a researcher at Princeton University. His latest book is Iran and the United States, an insider's view on the failed past and the road to peace. Ambassador Mousavian, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon.
Well, the U.S. and Iran have been at odds for over three decades now. What would you say lies at the root of this mistrust on both sides?
Actually, the mistrust is mutual. Americans, they do not trust Iran because of the events like 1979 hostage crisis. They believe Iranians are supporting the militant group deemed a terrorist by the U.S. They believe Iran is provoking anti-Americanism. They are afraid of Iran's role and influence in the region. On the issues like terrorism, weapons of mass destruction, Arab-Israeli peace process, these are major issues. Americans, they do not trust Iran. Iranians also, they have almost 60 years of history mistrusting the U.S., beginning from 1953. CIA backed a coup d'etat, ousting a very popular democratically elected prime minister. And then the U.S. Installed a dictator, a very corrupted dictator, supported for 25 years. Even after revolution, right after revolution, Saddam Hussein invaded Iran, killing or injuring over 1 million people. The U.S. supported the aggressor, Saddam Hussein. Saddam used chemical weapons, 100,000 Iranians, they were killed. Unfortunately, the U.S. provided material and technology for Saddam Hussein attacking Iran by chemical weapons, or downing Iranian passenger flights, killing 292 passengers, all type of sanctions, pressures, even sabotage against Iranian nuclear program, assassination of nuclear scientists. They have a long list of reasons to mistrust each other.
And how does that legacy of mistrust, founded in many cases, as you say, impact the issues at hand today?
I think right after election, we had a very good beginning when the two foreign ministers, John Kerry and Javad Zarif, they met each other. Then we had multiple meetings at the level of deputy ministers. And for the first time, Iran and the U.S. experienced, if they sit together in a good way, with goodwill, and discuss very sincerely and openly their views on one of the most delicate and complicated international issues, which is the nuclear, they can find a way to resolve. And fortunately, after just 3-4 months of direct high-level talks, we had interim deal between Iran and the world powers. We could only reach the interim deal because of direct talks between Iran and the U.S. We failed 10 years of nuclear negotiation only because we didn't have direct talks between Iran and the U.S. Therefore, this is a very good experience, a very good legacy for Iran and the U.S. to sit together, to negotiate for the way forward. I believe we need to immediately resolve the nuclear issue. The good news is that Iranians, it is now very clear for America and for American negotiation team that Iranians are ready to comply at the maximum level of transparency and cooperation with International Atomic Energy Organization. And therefore, they need to resolve the nuclear issue immediately and then to have a comprehensive package, a comprehensive dialogue with step-by-step approach. I mean, they need to negotiate on all the issues, on Iraq crisis, Syrian crisis, Afghanistan crisis, drug trafficking, many other issues. However, they need to have a phased approach practically.
You say that these issues, in particular, the nuclear negotiations need to be resolved quickly and that we are in a good place in terms of transparency on the Iranian side. But on the American side, there is criticism already that transparency is not the same thing as a concession and that Iran is not giving up as much as it is getting. How does the U.S. walk that line?
Actually, Americans, they do not say exactly like this because on transparency measures, the members of Non-Proliferation Treaty, NPT, they all are members of Safeguard Agreement, but one-third of the countries internationally, they have not signed to the other protocols, like additional protocol, which gives additional inspection, like Subsidiary Arrangement Code 3.1, which gives more inspection. Now, Iran is ready to sign off with all protocols and arrangements which would give the maximum level of transparency internationally, because the other arrangements like additional protocol is voluntarily. Two-thirds of international countries, they have accepted. One-third, they have not. 80 countries, they do not implement additional protocol. Therefore, this would be a concession. More. Yeah, Americans and the IAEA, International Atomic Energy Organization, they are asking Iran for a period, even access beyond non-proliferation treaty. And Iranians, they have shown they are ready for a specific period as a confidence building to give access beyond additional protocol, beyond NPT.
I want to move on and look at the situation with Iraq and how it affects the United States and Iran. What would you say Iran's long-term objectives are when it comes to dealing with Iraq?
See, for a decade, despite of all hostilities Iran and the U.S. they have had during last 35 years, in last decades, on issue like Iraq, despite of all animosity between Tehran and Washington, they both have supported the same government. And the U.S. allies in the region, they have challenged Maliki government in Iraq. Tehran and Washington, they have been in the same side, one. And another issue, Afghanistan, is exactly the same. For a decade, Tehran and Washington, they have supported the same government in Afghanistan. And the U.S. allies, they have challenged Karzai, supporting Taliban and extremists in Iraq and in Afghanistan. There is a great amount of understanding now between Tehran and Washington that the rising the threat of terrorism from the Middle East is going to bring the Middle East to a total collapse. And this is the most important threat to the national security and interests of Europe, U.S., Iran, and even the regional countries. And here the U.S. and Iran, they have common interests to cooperate to fight terrorism. They have a very good experience, historical experience, when in 2001, Iran and the U.S. shaked hands and jointly, shoulder by shoulder, they fought against terrorism, Al-Qaeda, Taliban, and they removed Taliban from Afghanistan. This is a very good example how Iran and the U.S., they can cooperate. And little by little, I think Tehran and Washington now they understand, although they have differences, but they have many issues of common interest communities.
And we have to leave it there. Ambassador Mousavian, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much. Have a good day.
That was Syed Hossein Mousavian, former Iranian ambassador to Germany and former Iranian nuclear negotiator. His latest book is called Iran and the United States, an insider's view on the failed past and the road to peace.